Stone. Wanna see my picture on the cover. Stone. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother. Yeah. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Reading today from the May 2025 edition of Rolling Stone magazine. In Random Notes, Live on Air, The King of Chat. Twitch streamers have become a growing force in music, and now Plaqueboy Max has the whole world watching. Plaqueboy Max might be one of the most sought-after names in the music business right now. At 22 years old, the popular Twitch streamer is tapped into the next generation of listeners who engage with new music via nonstop feeds of clips and snippets. He's among the top 15 streamers on Twitch and was recently commanded more than 5 million total watch hours each month on the platform. With franchises like In the Booth, where he invites guests to record a song live on stream, he's created a new type of ecosystem for hip-hop fans online, something like MTV for the TikTok generation. "We run the internet," Max says, of streamers like himself. He's seated across me on a spacious couch in the living room of his home near Hollywood Hills. Imagine you were watching Keeping Up with the Kardashians, which obviously was such a big show, but it's live with a Twitch chat where you can interact, Max says. That's where the streaming is heading. The fact that he refers to the Kardashians' hit reality TV show, later reborn as the Kardashians in past tense, says it all. And it's not just Max. The past year has seen live streamers rise to unprecedented heights in popular culture. Aidan Ross, whom Max credits as one of his early inspirations in streaming, is widely seen as being among the media figures who helped elect the current president. Kai Cenat is a household name, arguing about LeBron James on ESPN. It appears the future of entertainment has been taking place underneath the mainstream's nose. In conversation, Max, born Maxwell Elliott Dent, has the youthful confidence of a varsity athlete and the charm of a talk show host. He says he can tell when a song is getting made during one of his streaming sessions is going to catch on, like his collaboration with DDG Pink Dreads, which cracked the top 50 of Billboard's Hot R&B Hip Hop Songs chart earlier this year. Max says, "I'm going to be honest. Everything I make, I feel like is going to go crazy. It's just the energy. When I'm into it, I'm passionate about it." The artists invited to Max's stream are a well-curated blend of the internet-driven sounds of Gen Z. Think Netspend and Osamason. With more mainstream acts and rising stars like Cash Cobain. A week after we talk, he'll welcome Will Smith on the stream. Max says, "I just bring on whoever I fuck with, really. I might have Laser Dim, then I might have Baby Tron and Central C, then Xavier Sobased, then who knows, maybe Docelli down the line." Max grew up in suburban West Orange, New Jersey, which he refers to as the J, and has played basketball for years. Growing up, his parents and siblings, an older sister and a younger brother, had a running joke that Max would get famous and move them all into a higher tax bracket. "We used to always joke around and be like, okay, I'm going to take us out of the burbs," he says. The family group chat was literally named Max Out of the Burbs. When we meet, he's just getting back from London, where he'd be streaming every day for the past week. Those broadcasts culminated with an appearance from the UK rap legend Skepta, who graced Max's stream with an in-the-booth session. Attempting to translate the scale of such an appearance to American fans, commenters on TikTok compared it to Jay-Z showing up. When Skepta came on, he's like, "Oh, what's this? Why is it moving so fast?" Max says. The thousands of comments coming in live, fluttering across the screen in multicolored text at an intoxicating cadence, are also simply known as chat. We are all chat. Even those of us who are not commenting. To Max, this is a sign of things to come. "I think it's going to be super normal to go on Twitch streams.
not even as a guest. You're just living your life with whoever wants to watch, he says. I don't think people can even fathom what it's going to look like in 5 years. It's crazy. Even so, the house we're in isn't where Max actually streams. That's a few blocks away at the Faizi Clan House, the hub of the longtime S-Sports and content creator crew that Max officially joined last year. This house is just where he lives with fellow streamer Silky as a means of separating his life on stream from his IRL existence. He points to a few instances of over-the-line interactions with members of his community, including one overzealous fan who DM'd a girl he was seeing to congratulate her. Max recalls, "I think I was with her for Valentine's Day or something, and he literally DM'd her and said, 'I'm so happy you're with Max.'" Or even some that don't go to do with girls. "I lose a game of basketball. It's like they feel like they've lost. They mad as shit. I make the comparison to pop star fandom." "That's one way to look at it," Max says. "I'm telling you, this shit is crazy. I love it, though." Universal Studios and Capitol Records loom in the background of the Faizi Mansion, which has a view overlooking Studio City. Today, the place is mostly empty except for Max and his assistant, Yala, who is busy getting all the cameras ready to stream. Max has been going live every day for 2025 so far, and this being the 69th day of the year, he decided to invite one of hip-hop's foremost sexperts, Kevin Gates, to join him. Watching Max stream is surreal. In practice, he's basically talking to himself, but the room is somehow transformed by the invisible presence of the chat. It quickly dawns on me how, even if I were invited, entering the frame would have felt like jumping on stage at Madison Square Garden. "First, we got to thank the chat," Max asks them what they were up to today and get answers like Roblox, studying for hours, and of course, gooning. Gates and a few people from his camp arrive around 7 in the evening, shuffling back towards the kitchen while keeping their voices down so as not to interrupt the stream. In a few minutes, Gates, wearing a suit and bow tie, will be showing Max the meditation practice known as box breathing. 4 second inhale, 4 second exhale, in front of more than 50,000 people. Later, one of Max's friends, Tay, who is going through lady troubles, will get some free advice from Gates via FaceTime. The key is to like yourself. During the In the Booth segment, Gates pulls out a BlackBerry to write his verse, and Max has a stunned look of an archaeologist discovering an ancient relic. It would have all made for great TV. The stream is one of Max's best performing, topping out at more than 70,000 viewers. Gates stays laser-focused on the comments in the chat. At one point, Max gets up to go to the restroom, and all those viewers just sit and watch as Gates writes out a quick 8 bars on a piece of technology that predates many of them. It's his first time doing anything like this, and he seems almost struck by the raw immediacy of those thousands of people locked in and engaged. After the stream wraps, he marvels at what it must take to be a successful streamer. "You gotta be built different," Gates says. Also from Random Notes, Binge from Hell, The Lessons and Surprises of The Apprentice, the series that made Trump president, finally available to stream, shows him morphing from man to cartoon. In the 2004 series premiere of The Apprentice, Donald Trump reintroduces himself to America with a glossy anecdote about overcoming financial adversity. Narrating over a sweeping aerial shot of New York City, my city he calls it, and footage of him flying over his own shiny buildings in his Trump-branded helicopter, Trump declares, "It wasn't always so easy. About 13 years ago, I was seriously in trouble. I was billions of dollars in debt, but I fought back and I won, bigly. I used my brain, I used my negotiating skills, and I worked it out all." In reality, Trump reportedly climbed out of that $3 billion-plus debt in the early 1990s by taking loans from his wealthy father and siblings and evading federal taxes. But he doesn't get into those details. Apprentice producer Bill Pruitt later admitted the show played fast and loose with the facts, and conned us all about our future president. And thanks to Jeff Bezos' Amazon Prime Video, which recently began streaming the first 7 seasons of the reality competition for the first time, we can finally revisit Hal. It is jarring at first how measured the apprentice Trump seems compared with the buffoon we now see in the news, not to mention way less cartoonishly orange. He comes off as a fair-minded, charming, even empathetic figure. In episode 7, he pulls a contestant aside to ask her about her ailing mother's health and offer what appears to be genuine support and concern. I felt like I was talking to a friend instead of this mogul billionaire, she gushes afterwards. He exchanges friendly banter with the contestants, who seem to enjoy being around him, even when he's deciding which of them to fire. In one boardroom meeting at the end of episode 6, Trump asks Omasara Mangalt how she thinks her teammate Heidi did in that day's challenge. Heidi was fantastic, Omasara responds. And I haven't always been a fan of Heidi. I haven't always thought that she was professional, nor does she have much class or finesse. That was very nice, Trump interjects, making the whole room laugh. This is the one of the worst compliments I have ever heard, he says. Of course, glimpses of the Trump we know shine through. He makes a show of loathing, disloyalty, and weakness. In the same episode, he lights into Jesse, another teammate Omasara had insulted, for failing to punch back, telling her he found it repulsive how she let herself be treated like a dog. He fires her for that reason. Trump also uses the show to cast himself as the embodiment of the American dream. At the end of each episode, he sends the winning team to experience a taste of his lifestyle. The show's first-ever winners are rewarded with a tour of Trump's Manhattan penthouse, a gaudy marble and gold eyesore. This is like rich, one contestant marvels. The episode 2 prize is a private jet trip to Boston, which a young blonde named Christy describes as a teaching tool. You have to want those things and aspire to those things if you want to be like Trump, she explains. More random notes. 1 of 1. I don't have any regrets at all. Who wants to read about actors bitching? Val Kilmer. Always a bit off kilter, the actor, who died in April at the age of 65, was a charming and prickly eccentric with a leading man's face. In a 2003 interview with Rolling Stone, Kilmer stood by his choices in Hollywood and in life. Continuing in random notes. Lone Star. Charlie Crockett is taking Texas to the world. The prolific singer-songwriter from San Benito is roping in fans with his timeless sound and confident swagger. Before Charlie Crockett kicked off his particular show, he hung out, sipping from a red plastic cup and making small talk the same way he has before most concerts in his career. Only when an event organizer shouted, "Charlie, we're ready," did he snap back to the moment and calmly slide behind the wheel of a jet-black 1965 Thunderbird convertible. This played out in a tunnel inside of NRG Stadium at the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, just before Crockett headlined the room of 52,000 for the first time in mid-March. As he put the car in gear, Taylor Day Grace, Crockett's wife and a fellow musician, ran to the driver's side of the Thunderbird, kissed him, and said, "Have fun out there." Then the coolest man in Texas drove himself up to the biggest stage in Texas. "I'm not a cowboy, I'm a cowboy singer," Crockett says. That's what Jack Clement said about Waylon Jennings, too. That's in your mind. That's lifetime drifter mentality, man. 2 days prior, Crockett is lounging in a chair at Austin's Continental Club, the venerable dive where he landed one of his first gigs in the Texas Capitol circa 2016. This time around, he has an interview with Rolling Stone in between record store performances for the release of Lonesome Drifter, his 14th studio album and 3rd in less than a year, following 2024's $10 Cowboy and Vision of Dallas. Crockett has woven so much of his life into his music that his story feels well told. But to summarize, he was born in San Benito, Texas, not far from Brownsville and the Mexican border town of Matamoros, and raised by his mother in a nearby trailer park. He grew up poor and spent his formative years traversing the country by train, often busking in cities like New Orleans, Dallas, and by 2009, New York. From there, Crockett bounced around from California to Europe, sometimes farming and sometimes playing music. He returned to Texas in 2015 and found friends like Leon Bridges, with whom Crockett will tour this summer on a coast-to-coast run they're calling the Crooner and the Cowboy Tour. Along the way, Crockett found plenty of trouble. He was busted for drug distribution. He said he nearly derailed his life in a stock fraud operation engineered by his half-brother. And there was the open-heart surgery in 2019 that Crockett went under for a congenital disorder. Lonesome Drifter marks Crockett's debut for Island Records, home to pop stars like Sabrina Carpenter and Chappelle Roan, and fellow country singer Wyatt Flores. He recorded it in L.A. with Shooter Jennings, the Grammy-winning son of Waylon Jennings. "He's wild," Jennings says. "He crashed the performance at the same time he's writing it. I've seen him do it now hundreds of times." On the track Easy Money, Crockett manages to cover a wide swath of his life before the song's crescendo of "I woke up in New York City without a name, wasn't long before I learned the hustler's game." In Life of a Country Singer, he furthers his story, singing, "I'm riding out to meet my glory and breaking my damn heart in songs for you." It's true. When a heart breaks in a Charlie Crockett song, it shatters like glass on concrete. "What did Waylon say about, 'Are you sure Hank done it this way?'" Crockett asks. "It took me 10 minutes to write, but it took me 10 years to think it up." There's a lot of that in my music. He and Grace make their home in Spicewood, Texas, not far from Willie Nelson's Luck Ranch. If Crockett is an ambassador for anything, he says, it's the Lone Star's path to stardom, one that Nelson perfected in the 70s when he split from Nashville for Texas. "The problem with Tennessee is that Texans are foreigners here," Crockett says. "It's different from L.A., where people see me and say, 'Ah, look, it's Big Tex.' Those city slickers in New York are intrigued by Texans. What I'm doing out here, I'm taking my brand of Texas to the world." That state of mind was on full display at the Houston Radio. This half of the room says Charlie Crockett is too country, and this half of the room says Charlie Crockett isn't country enough, he says, before kicking off a solo acoustic version of Life of a Country Singer. The remark was a nod to a constant low-grade stream of criticism that Crockett's down-home demeanor must be some kind of front. "I played on the street," he tells me. "I played on subway cars. I worked on farms, and I played campfire jams. I hustled up money to dress better, to buy myself an amp and electric guitar, or just buy a drink at the bar." He was surprised at first that people found him polarizing. "I came to realize that the image that I cut, compared to George Strait or someone, I'm controversial," he adds. "For whatever reason, I bring some pretty strong feelings out of people who see me." After a green room toast with friends, family, crew, and a sizable contingent from Island, Crockett and Grace board their tour bus for a 3-hour ride to his next show at another Texas rodeo. "Find me at 1 in the morning if you want to hear the truth," he deadpans before muting the television, almost always tuned to a Western movie and talking some more. Crockett tells me he's seen how Nelson built a career on his own terms. That's why Lonesome Drifter marks 3 albums in a year and why he and Jennings have another one already holstered. "I got to make sure that I can put out records quickly," Crockett says, as the TV flickers behind him on the bus. "That's the only reason I'm here. None of this would have happened if I didn't put out a lot of records." Turning to Rolling Stone's Comedy's Class of 2025, The moment's brightest stars are changing the game on screen and on stage. Marcelo Hernandez, the Saturday Night Live breakout, has a special on the way. The hearts of thousands upon thousands of fans and an endless supply of Miami hustle. Trying to find the end of the line outside the Helium Comedy Club in Alpharetta, Georgia, is nearly impossible right now. You walk for blocks and blocks, passing girls in high heels with Bad Bunny screensavers on their phones, middle-aged couples who drove in from the surrounding suburbs, southern moms with big hair ready for a night out, all drawn here by the magnetism of Marcelo Hernandez. Tonight, on a windy evening in March, Hernandez is testing out a new set made up of material he's rehearsing for his first ever comedy special due out later this year on Netflix. The eclectic crowd is proof of just how much Hernandez's career has ballooned as the 27-year-old comedian has leapfrogged his way to stardom on Saturday Night Live. From the outside, it seems like an incredibly fast come-up, achieved through a quick puff of gravelly-voiced charm and loose cannon spontaneity. But to Hernandez, it's been a gradual build, starting when he first joined the cast in 2022. Me and Devin Walker would be sitting in a dressing room dressed as DoorDash guys, like little pop-in roles, he says of those early days. When you're there a little longer, you get more responsibility. Now there are countless Saturday Night Live characters he's known for, each one more viral than the last. There's the hip-swiveling Dominican baseball player gyrating his way into the Major League Baseball playoffs, which got 1.6 million views on YouTube. The kid introducing his white girlfriend to his highly critical Latina mom, played by Pedro Pascal in bright pink lipstick, which got 8.7 million views. And bride-stealing, goatee-wearing Lothario Domingo, who is actually a doctor and randomly a model, and he volunteers with Weird Sick Animals. That got 18 million views. In case anyone doubts the man's range, he's been a cicada, a 4.8 magnitude earthquake, and a frozen embryo from Alabama. While he's proven he can do a little bit of everything, his brand of comedy is distinctly marked by his experience growing up Latino in Miami. You can see that in the sketches he's in, but also in the ones he's helped write for Spanish-speaking guests ranging from Bad Bunny to Ana de Armas, who have found someone who can understand their cultural lexicon and can add nuance to their roles in a way that's felt rare on Saturday Night Live in the past. Marcelo is effortlessly himself, an identity shaped by Latina dad and Miami, strong woman, a hungry brain, all of which are evident in a single gesture or look, Pascal tells Rolling Stone in an email. I think he's a star. Hernandez's next big act is this special, which he's been writing during breaks from Saturday Night Live. At Helium, he does three sets back-to-back, playing with the order and adding little bits here and there. You're exploring because these are good crowds, he tells me the next day when we meet up for lunch at an Italian restaurant near his hotel. Jerry Seinfeld always said good crowds help you explore and tough crowds help you edit. So this was a very exploratory weekend. It's hard to imagine Hernandez encountering tough crowds these days. He's reached a point of cultural ubiquity where he gets recognized pretty much wherever he goes. The second he walks into the restaurant, dressed in a black T-shirt and sunglasses, a woman sitting at a nearby table bursts out, "I'm such a fan. I love you on TV." Hernandez lets out a good-natured, raspy laugh and replies, thank you, that's very sweet," which only seems to attract more accidental attention. "You know you can't mask that voice, right?" our waiter tells him as he brings over menus. "I'm proud of you, brother." Part of Hernandez's allure is precisely that he seems so approachable. He gives off supreme kid brother vibes and at the same time channels the class clown every girl had a crush on in high school. When I tell a few girlfriends I'm interviewing him, The news is met with some version of a squeal heard only at dog frequencies. He's 5'8" and stocky. He wasn't Saturday Night Live's Short King ambassador for nothing, with curly hair that seems to get wilder the more energetic he gets. And though he considers every question seriously, hardly ever breaking eye contact, there's always a twinkle of anarchy past his retinas. Despite all the humor and affability, Hernandez is also intensely work-focused, and there's a sense of gravity as he nears a new career phase with a ton more recognition. He'd be lying if he said he's not nervous, especially about this special. "It's daunting. It's my wedding," he quips. "I'm getting married to these jokes, you know. But I've been with them for a long time." Once you've been with them this long, you're together. A lot of Hernandez's material comes directly from his upbringing. He was born in Miami, the older of two kids. His mom left Cuba as a teenager and moved to the Dominican Republic, where she eventually met Hernandez's father. Hernandez is especially close to his mother. She has inspired several sketches, but both parents are fixtures in his comedy. "My mom is a very well-rounded, funny, like roast funny, goofy funny. She can be witty," he says, and then pauses for a second. "And my dad, I think, can only be described as a cartoon character," he says, laughing, noting that his father is a kind of outgoing guy everyone in the Dominican Republic knows. His parents split up early in his childhood. If Hernandez had to put a finger on where his comedic impulses come from, that might be a start. "My parents get divorced when I'm young, and I'm trying to find some fun in it, you know. It's not that funny when your parents get divorced and you're little and you kind of have to deal with it." But he's also always been wildly animated and with the inability to sit still. "I'm just a very hyperactive person. Where there's silence, I get uncomfortable." That kinetic energy meant that in high school, at Miami's all-boys Belen Jesuit Preparatory School, he was admittedly a bit of a nightmare. "I was using my powers for evil. I was misbehaving in class, trying to get my friends to misbehave, making fun of the teacher," he says. But one teacher noticed that Hernandez had a natural theater and urged him to do drama. He finally gave in his senior year. Hernandez also was a serious athlete who has been playing soccer since he was 4, and he ended up as a midfielder at Division III John Carroll University in Cleveland, Ohio. There, a friend took him to an open mic night at a comedy club. It was such a rush that he did 2 sets in the same evening. Pretty soon, Hernandez was taking a weekly bus to New York City, handing out flyers outside a club in exchange for a 5-minute set. "I was on the street selling tickets next to drug dealers," he says. "I used to have a joke about it. I'd be like, 'Comedy show?' And then the guy next to me would be like, 'Cocaine. And he has a better product, let's be honest.'" All the traveling between Ohio and New York got so intense that Hernandez made the decision to leave the soccer team. "I cried to my coaches. It was a real sad moment," he says, laughing now. "You're like breaking up with your wife. I had spent 14 years with this woman, and I had to break up with her for a woman I had just met, and it wasn't going well." His mom came up from Miami to see him perform once, but took off before he went on stage. "She cried and she gave me $20 and she left," Hernandez recalls. Yet Hernandez did become a regular on the New York City circuit, endearing himself to other comedians and to clubs. In 2022, he was tapped for Just for Laughs, a comedy festival in Montreal, where he thinks Saturday Night Live casting agents first spotted him. Months later, he was brought to the Rockefeller Center in New York to audition. "My mom started smoking cigarettes again during that moment," he says. "So did I." He pantomimes rapid chain smoking. "She was like, 'Marcelo, how did it go?' And I'm like, 'I don't know. No one laughed.' And she's like, 'Maybe that happens to everybody. I'm going to do some research.'" Obviously, Hernandez nailed it. He made headlines as one of only 4 Latinos cast on the show in its 50-year history. Chilean-born comedian Horacio Sanz, who joined in 1998, was the first. Fred Armisen, whose mother is Venezuelan, followed in 2022. and Mexican-American Melissa Villasenor became the first Latina cast member on Saturday Night Live in 2018. I was happy to be one of the four. It's not a lot, so there's a bit of responsibility I felt too, he says. But also it's like I cannot write about what I'm writing about. That's just what naturally comes to me. His perspective and his mass appeal feels especially significant on television, where Latino representation has been lacking for years. A 2024 study from the Latino Donor Collaborative showed Latinos make up only 9.9% of main cast members on scripted shows, despite being nearly 20% of the United States population. The idea of representation keeps me taking back to something I experienced the night of his show. As I was making my way to the front of the club to pay for my drink, a blonde woman with a strong southern accent reached toward me and yelled, "Excuse me, do you work here?" I stared at her blankly before the server walking next to me, a white man wearing a t-shirt with the logo of the comedy club, asked her what she needed. The interaction jolts me. I keep wondering why she'd assume a Latina woman in that audience worked for her instead of a bearded white guy. I recount the story to Hernandez at lunch, and he watches me steadily. His first reaction is to think about the way we all walk through the world with our set of biases and preconceived notions. "I think Latinos do that as well," he says. Then he starts to smile a bit. I try my best to avoid my feeling of sensitivity. I think it's because when I was little, any time I would feel like I was going through something unjust, my mom would go, "Drama, drama, drama," he says, breaking into a full Cuban accent with an exaggerated rolling of the tongue. "So I want to do that to you." His voice gets stereo level loud as he dives into a bit. "Drama, drama, drama. What happened? Did she take your money? Did she take your child? Did she take your house? So it was a fantastic night." We're both laughing hysterically. But then he grows serious for a second. "I get it, I get it. I've been through it," he says quietly. "I've definitely been through like a what are you doing here type of thing. Or when I talk on the phone in Spanish, the looks. The looks you get at the wrong place when you're screaming at your Cuban mom in Spanish." Hernandez's humor has never been political or polemical. He seems like he's always just trying to find the truth and the comedy in his own experiences and those of the people he grew up around. When he does that, a more radical thing happens, whether Hernandez intends it or not. It illuminates the interior lives of a large swath of Americans with immigrant backgrounds, perhaps stretching the imagination of narrow-minded viewers. "I wonder if to a white audience it feels like something new," Pascal says. "It must. To me, it's deeply familiar. It's like someone I've always known who's made me laugh my whole life, and that's because he brings every bit of his culture with him." That kind of representation feels more critical under an administration that has vilified immigrants, painting harsh caricatures of Latino communities in particular. I wonder out loud if any of that makes him think about his work in a different way. "I don't want to change my voice for anyone," he says slowly. "I want to be who I am, always, and I think the special reflects that. You talk about what you know. So if there's something going on in the world and I think that I know about it, I'm going to talk about it. But I don't try to overstep my bounds." He pauses again. "But if you are someone that is saying, I hope that Marcelo, because he says he's such a Latino and a kid of immigrants, I hope that he touches on that topic in his special, I think you're going to be fine. You'll see." What's more pressing to him is to keep getting better as a comic and a writer. "I always just try to be like, focus on the work," he says. He tries not to think about the highs and lows too much, though he will share some of the best moments he's experienced so far. One was when Bad Bunny hosted Saturday Night Live last October and reprised the Protective Mom sketch with Pascal. "I cried that night. That was like a big full-circle moment because I admire Benito a lot, the way he works, the type of person he is. And Pedro Pascal, he changed my life with the first Protective Mom sketch," he says. "I look back on my younger self like, you would not believe this. A few of his heroes have checked in too. Bro, Billy Crystal, texted the other day. He says, "He's a legend, and I can't believe that I met Adam Sandler. He's heard from Rosalia, who he thinks would be amazing as a host. Rosalia is a funny dude. And who's a host he really vibed with? I think Charlie and I could be friends," he says. "We got good banter." He pulls my phone up like he's leaving Charlie XCX a voicemail. Right, Charlie? The pressure could be a lot for someone as young as Hernandez. But if it ever feels like too much, if he starts to freak out or take himself too seriously or worry about what people think, it isn't hard to imagine a voice ricocheting in his head, drama, 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 and then it'll just keep going. Also featured in Comedy's Class of 2025, Jeff Hiller. At 49, the journeyman actor and improv star is hitting his stride. As the title of his new memoir, Actress of a Certain Age, My 20-Year Trail to Overnight Success, suggests, Jeff Hiller did not take the express bus to stardom. Best known as Droll, best friend of Bridget Everett's Sam on the HBO series Somebody Somewhere, Hiller accepted dozens of oddball parts while bouncing around showbiz, offing killers and creeps thanks to his unconventional look. The book, out June 10th, chronicles the hustle it took to make it as a full-time performer. He shares some lessons. These lessons include practice gratitude. One of Hiller's first TV roles was in the 2005 FX dark comedy Starved, centered on an eating disorder support group. He was cast as a sex worker providing services off camera in a bathroom stall where two guys were trying to make themselves vomit. It was my first sitcom job, and for that I was grateful. Know when it's time to quit. Before Hiller ventured into performing, he was a social worker. The challenges left him deflated. At the beginning, I was like, I'm going to change the world. Then when I got there, it was just like, oh, I can't change shit. You really need to be okay with a lot of conflict. And I just didn't have that skill. Saying I was really bad at it is also a way to alleviate my guilt over abandoning literal homeless people for an improv team, where I was making no money in the basement of a grocery store. Turning to this edition's one of the feature stories in National Affairs, Citizen Musk, The Worst 100 Days. He's blazed a staggering trail of destruction as the head of Trump's DOGE, firing tens of thousands of workers while cashing in. But a protest movement is growing in its wake. Ben Vizicaro had his dream job working as a wildlife biologist with the Los Padres National Forest in California. He was moving up the ladder, had recently received a positive performance review, and was making the world a better place, he says. Yet over President's Day weekend in February, Donald Trump's administration told Vizicaro he was being let go for his performance. Vizicaro was one of many thousands of probationary federal workers who were baselessly fired by Elon Musk and his so-called Department of Government Efficiency as part of Trump's effort to purge the federal workforce and make it more MAGA. It was crushing. My job is my identity, Vizicaro says. How I've defined myself since I was 5 years old is that I love birds and bird watching. Talking with Rolling Stone magazine in March, following his firing, Vizicaro wondered what would happen to his health insurance and whether he would need to move in with his parents. When a Democratic lawmaker invited Vizicaro as a guest to Trump's joint address to Congress in March, he found himself seated near Elon Musk. He took the opportunity to confront the world's richest man. According to Vizicaro, he described his job to Musk and asked, "Am I a waste?" He says, Musk, with a very condescending smirk, hit him with a line from the 1999 movie Office Space, "What would you say you do here?" It was a dubious callback to the scene in which a pair of management consultants interview a worker and force him to justify his job before he's fired. Like countless Wall Street traders who took the wrong lesson from Gordon Gekko's "Greed is good" speech, Elon missed the point of Office Space. that culture is dehumanizing and bosses like him are odious cretins. Soon after Trump's and Republicans' 2024 wins, which Musk supported with $209.90 million in political spending, the Tesla CEO publicly mused about using this line from Office Space on federal workers. He posted it in November on X, the social media platform he owns, with a laugh-crying emoji, resharing his earlier post of an AI-generated image in which he's seated at a conference table behind a placard that reads, D-O-G-E. 2 weeks later, Musk announced, "I rewatched Office Space tonight for the fifth time to prepare for at Doge." The billionaire reportedly had a Doge t-shirt made emblazoned with his favorite line. And 1 week in February, Musk threatened to fire every federal worker who failed to respond to an email asking them, "What did you do last week?" Elon Musk and the White House did not respond to Rolling Stone's request for comment. With Doge, Musk has gleefully banished tens of thousands of federal employees, canceled life-saving aid, and repeatedly threatened America's safety net programs, all as part of a purported hunt for waste, fraud, and abuse. He's governed as an out-of-touch corporate villain, laughing about this carnage while partying, posting, delivering big payments to voters, although the amounts mean virtually nothing to him, and cashing in on new contracts and business opportunities, sometimes appearing high out of his mind. Even administration officials and Trump loyalists on Capitol Hill joked about the latest outrages of Prime Minister Musk. At every turn in his crusade of destruction, the Tesla and SpaceX CEO has dared the courts and a weak Democratic opposition to stop him. But it didn't take long for ordinary Americans to get pissed off, with protests against Doge, Musk, and his companies erupting nationwide. "The American people are saying, you know what, Elon Musk?" says Everett Kelly, president of the American Federation of Government Employees, a federal labor union that has brought legal challenges against the Trump administration on behalf of the more than 820,000 workers across government agencies that it represents. "We're not buying what you're selling. We believe you to be a liar." Organizers have mounted a Tesla takedown campaign, with tens of thousands around the globe showing up at dealerships to condemn Doge, according to the group. They have encouraged Tesla owners to sell their cars and stockholders to dump their shares, since much of Musk's wealth comes from his stake in the electric vehicle manufacturer. "People have asked, what is Doge?" says a retiree at an anti-Tesla protest in Los Angeles in March, explaining that she and her husband are trying to educate people about the harm that Musk's pet project is causing. Passing motorists honk in support of the approximately 25 people gathered at a Tesla center despite the rain. Some hold signs denouncing Musk as a Nazi. He has denied any association with Nazism. While another poster at the rally simply reads, "Not sure about this Elon guy." There is a growing movement to divest Tesla stock in a precipitous decline, says actor and writer Alex Winter, who launched Tesla Takedown with other activists in February. Things are moving in the right direction. Prior to Trump's inauguration, observers weren't sure how seriously to take the idea of a Musk-led government officially commissioned, but the billionaire and Doge have been at the vanguard of Trump's shockingly lawless second administration. Musk has spearheaded the president's purge of the federal workforce and his efforts to consolidate information and power over federal funds, despite never being elected, appointed, or confirmed to hold such a pivotal role. Musk is technically a special government employee, a designation that allows him to bypass a Senate confirmation process and avoid publicly reporting his financial holdings. Doge was created by renaming the U.S. Digital Service and moving it under the executive office in an apparent bid to circumvent public record laws. The ethics watchdog American Oversight has sued to force the group to comply with those laws and preserve materials subject to Freedom of Information Act requests. The public deserves to know the full extent of the damage, said Interim Executive Director Chioma Chukwuka in a statement on an April court order requiring Doge to fulfill this legal obligation. Trump and Musk have tried to grant the new office expansive authorities never envisioned by Congress, including the ability to impound or freeze funds appropriated by lawmakers. Experts say the arrangement is unconstitutional at several levels, as are Doge's mass firings and its attempts to shutter or pause the work of whole government agencies. A lawsuit brought by personnel of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, laid out many of these arguments, contending that Musk has acted as an officer of the United States without having been duly appointed to such a role, and that Doge acted to eliminate USAID, a federal agency created by statute, where only Congress may do so. A federal judge in Maryland agreed, finding that Musk and Doge likely violated the Constitution as they dismantled the office. Another judge ordered the Trump administration to rehire thousands of probationary employees terminated by Doge. As a publication, the legal battle is still ongoing. Visit Cheryl, the wildlife biologist, was among those rehired. The administration is still moving ahead with even larger mass firings. Musk and his lieutenants, many pulled from his own companies, others young techie college dropouts lacking in government experience, have demanded unprecedented access to sensitive personal information and government payment systems, leading to still more legal challenges. Federal judges have found that Trump's administration likely violated privacy and administrative laws when it gave Doge sweeping access to personal private data held by the Social Security Administration, the Treasury Department, and the Education Department. Regardless, Doge has continued to operate with the same playbook Musk used after acquiring Twitter, showing a zeal for speedy termination and little regard for how departments function. Throughout the chaos and confusion of Trump's return to power, Musk also strove to cultivate the image he's long maintained as a workhorse, showman, and expert in varied fields. He reportedly told friends he was sleeping at Doge's offices, rehashing claims he previously made about sleeping on a Tesla factory floor. He's continually posted grandiose and often inaccurate estimates of how much money Doge has saved, and he seemed to relish his role as an all-powerful agitator. Musk began regularly smearing his enemies as retards on X and targeting judges who ruled against the administration or blocked Doge's incursions. He grew bold enough to describe Social Security, long considered untouchable, as the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time. On stage at Trump's post-inauguration event, Musk threw a straight-arm salute to the crowd, then responded to the ensuing backlash with a series of puns on names of high-ranking Nazis from Adolf Hitler's inner circle. Speaking virtually to the far-right German political party Alternative für Deutschland, Musk argued that Germany had placed too much of a focus on past guilt. At the 2025 Conservative Political Action Conference in February, Musk waved around a chainsaw he said would slice through bureaucracy. This on the same day that his former partner Grimes publicly begged him on X to respond to her about a medical crisis experienced by one of their three children. "I am becoming meme," he said on stage. "I'm living the meme. You know, it's like there's living the dream and there's living the meme, and that's pretty much what's happening." The bizarre CPAC appearance prompted speculation about Musk's state of mind and recreational drug use, as he was wearing sunglasses inside and had difficulty stringing sentences together. People close to Musk have told the Wall Street Journal they have known him to use illegal drugs, including LSD, cocaine, ecstasy, and mushrooms, a source of concern of some of the board members overseeing his companies. Musk has denied using illegal drugs, though he has spoken about his use of prescription ketamine, a dissociative anesthetic. Some senior Trump administration officials and cabinet members have found themselves deeply annoyed by Musk. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, three people familiar with the matter, say, hasn't hidden his disdain for Musk, with some State Department officials nicknaming the Tesla billionaire Crazy Uncle Elon, two of those sources tell Rolling Stone. I've been in the same room with Elon, and he always tries to be funny, and he's not funny, like at all, says a senior Trump administration official. He makes these jokes and little asides and smiles and looks almost hurt if you don't lap up his humor. I keep using the word annoying. A lot of people who have to deal with him do. But the word doesn't do the situation justice. Elon just thinks he's smarter than everyone else in the room and acts like it, even when it's clear he doesn't know what he's talking about. Musk has gnawed at the patience of an array of high-ranking administration officials to the point that, according to this official and two others, Trump lieutenants have walked out of meetings and earnestly asked one another if they thought Musk was high. Administration officials joked to one another about subjecting Musk to mandatory drug testing, which Musk himself said would be a great idea for federal employees. A lawyer for Musk has said he's regularly and randomly drug tested at SpaceX and has never failed a test. Talking to the guy is sometimes like listening to real rusty nails on a chalkboard, says a senior Trump administration official, who adds that Musk is not much of a team player either. He's just the most irritating person I've ever had to deal with, and that is saying something. With Trump's blessing, Musk has injured a climate of fear that has infected nearly every corner of the U.S. executive branch. When DOGE's nerd army has moved to take over federal agencies, if the demands are not immediately met, Musk's minions have snapped at senior government officials. Do I need to call Elon? The emails that Musk has sent to federal employees have been so intentionally dickish that several have produced an avalanche of what one Trump administration official calls very rude pranks and replies. Some of these crass responses include, per messages reviewed by Rolling Stone, graphic sexual images, including content involving urine and feces. I know Elon probably won't see it, but I hope he sees it, says one now former federal employee who says they replied to one such email with an image of a human butthole. Musk is apparently amused by the unrest. Aside from his public memeing, when he has privately messaged associates in confidence about reports from federal staffers about how their lives have been wrecked, the Tesla CEO has been known to react with laugh-crying emojis, according to a source with direct knowledge of the matter. At the Social Security Administration, Musk and DOGE appear to be creating a ticking time bomb, making big cuts and changes that may prevent some recipients from getting the benefits they are owed. The tech oligarch has repeatedly warned that millions of Americans over the age of 100 are receiving benefits, a flagrant misrepresentation of agency data. Trump has run with this falsehood, too, even as his acting Social Security commissioner has acknowledged that these people are not necessarily receiving benefits. Musk has claimed there are extreme levels of fraud in Social Security, although he and DOGE haven't provided any evidence. He's argued without basis that hundreds of billions of dollars in fraud per year are going to undocumented immigrants from entitlement programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. The constant griping about entitlements is making an impact. When people lose their Social Security benefits, they are blaming Musk and DOGE. Two administration officials and another Trump advisor tell Rolling Stone that when Musk has publicly decried Social Security as a Ponzi scheme, some close to Trump have tried to diplomatically remind Musk that this could be damaging politically. We like winning elections, and you may have noticed that a lot of our voters are elderly, the Trump advisor notes. The complaint from Trump land brass about Musk's inability to absorb or entertain new information is a common one. According to the Trump advisor and an administration official, the DOGE captain has like stubbornly responded with comments like, "It's a Ponzi scheme, though it is not." As Musk and his minions claim, they're hunting for wasteful spending. The tech mogul is vying for new contracts at agencies that regulate his many business interests, a situation that poses obvious conflicts of interest. The Trump White House has asserted that Musk can police his own conflicts and excuse himself from DOGE's work overseeing certain contracts if he believes it's necessary. As part of their purge, Musk and DOGE fired hundreds of probationary employees at the Federal Aviation Administration, which last year proposed fining Musk SpaceX for regulatory and safety violation. Musk also pressured the last FAA administrator to resign, leaving it without leadership when an Army helicopter and commercial jet collided over the Potomac River near D.C. in January, killing 67 people. The agency has started utilizing Starlink, Musk's satellite internet service, to help upgrade the systems it uses to manage America's airspace. Musk has tried to spin this as charity, posting that Starlink terminals are being sent at no cost to the taxpayer on an emergency basis to restore air traffic control connectivity. However, as Rolling Stone has reported, FAA officials directed staff to quickly locate tens of millions of dollars to fund a Starlink deal. The New York Times separately reported in March that Starlink is now being used on the White House campus despite security concerns. Trump's Department of Defense just awarded SpaceX billions more in contracts to put sensitive military satellites in space. Doge is reportedly using Musk's Grok AI chat box literally as it slashes the government. Two sources with knowledge of the matter tell Rolling Stone that Musk Doge staffers have grilled DOD employees about the Golden Dome project, which is Trump's fantastical proposal to build a space-based missile defense system to protect the United States, an idea ready made for Starlink. Their questions were so specific that Pentagon officials wondered if the Doge staff had access to highly sensitive and guarded information. "Why do these fucking kids know this?" is how one of the sources described their bewilderment at the time. With Doge, Musk has effectively infiltrated agencies that are supposed to oversee his businesses. This situation creates risk, experts say, as officials may not feel like they can scrutinize Musk's businesses too closely. Case in point, in late February, the FAA cleared SpaceX to launch another unmanned test flight of its Starship rocket a month after one exploded. Starship exploded again midair, raining debris over Florida and the Caribbean and disrupting nearly 500 flights. The FAA's probe of the first explosion concluded that the probable cause was stronger than anticipated vibrations during flight. The agency noted that SpaceX had implemented corrective actions prior to launching the second rocket, which exploded too. This concludes the reading of Rolling Stone magazine. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.